Yeah, hey, this is Lucas Barfield, and you tuned into the Cannabis Corner right here on Radio Tacoma, 101.9 KTAH. Thanks so much for tuning in today. We have a great show planned for you today. Later on, Casey Connell of Contender Gardens will be coming on with us later to talk about clean cannabis. And before that, we have some headlines to get into. If this is the first time you're tuning into the show, this is a show all about cannabis, and we go over some headlines, and then we go over a topic, and then we go out with some... it's a bus segment where we talk about how cannabis is still illegal and a little bit of information and news about prohibition. So let's get right into our headlines this week. Our first headline is quite a fascinating headline, and it talks about how cannabis evolved. And this headline says that a virus caused the gene mutation that produces CBD and THC. So according to the researchers that came out of the University of Toronto in Canada, after they did a chromosome map of the cannabis sativa plant, they found a bundle of genes and DNA around it that indicated that a virus had come into the plant and mutated the DNA of the plant to better suit itself. So if you know anything about viruses, basically virus is just a strand of DNA. And the way they work is they'll inject themselves into the cell and sort of hijack the DNA of the host and then start producing new viruses. And according to this study, that is what happened with the genes of the cannabis plant. And the result was the cannabis plant started producing, after the virus left, started to produce this CBD and THC. And this is a question I've always wondered. So how all of a sudden, out of all the plants in the world, now there are other plants that produce cannabinoids, but this one produces more than most, it seems. Did this plant start producing these compounds? And this happened millions of years ago. And of course, as soon as humans came across it, they started helping the process along. So humans definitely had a role in evolving the cannabis plant. And if you really think about it, the cannabis plant is one of the most evolutionary successful organisms out there. I mean, the plant has spread almost all parts of the world. Even looking at Alaska, where a plant like this do not grow, people are growing it indoors. So on an evolutionary scale, and judging that metric, cannabis is a very successful plant, and it all started with a gene mutation caused by a virus, according to the researchers. Fascinating. So the next headline comes out of Florida, where, if you remember, they recently just had in 2016, they passed a medical marijuana bill, a constitutional amendment, which what we should have done here in Washington, but they have a constitutional amendment that allows people around the state to start purchasing and producing medical cannabis. And they have a pretty robust system down there with a lot of stuff going on. There's medical cannabis shops in almost every community in Florida. According to this article, Trulieve, which is one of the big retailers down there, they are trying to open up. They have 23 stores right now, so they want to go above the cap, 25. So the Department of Health has put a cap on the number of licenses each entity can hold, like Trulieve, so they can't hold any more than 25. And Trulieve says, hold on a second, Amendment 2 did not say anything about a cap, and right now the judge is not ruled on this, but is looking at this question. And actually the cap runs out April 1st. Let's see, April 1st, 2020, that's when the cap expires. So the Trulieve plaintiffs are really putting pressure on the judge and the state to lift this cap. And speaking of caps, there's caps all around the country when it comes to cannabis. Every state that has legalized cannabis for adult use, as well as medical cannabis, you have communities out there saying, no, we don't want this within our borders. Even here in Washington, one of the first states to legalize it, local communities have said no. And that is their right under our system. But in my opinion, it's quite folly, because cannabis, people who use cannabis, they're going to use it whether they can get it legally or not, basically what I'm going to say. Because a person who is suffering from cancer, a person who's suffering depression, and they're going to use this as medicine, they'll just drive over to the next town and get it. And if it's legal, that's perfectly fine. And they're not going to be, you know, the towns that are saying no to the cannabis businesses, they're losing out on economic growth and opportunity in their community. So this is a problem all around the country with these bans, and I chalk it up to just what this show is all about. People just don't know, and they're not, it's kind of scary to them. It's been legal, so illegal for so long that letting this come into their town or their community is just really scary for them. And actually, we have a place right next door to us in Lakewood that is, it took them a while. It took them about 5 years to rule on this, but they finally in 2018 said, no, you can't have cannabis business in Lakewood. But I've been told that over in Lakewood, there are still people selling cannabis out on the street. So that's a problem because, you know, Lakewood should have legal cannabis and it should be regulated there. And that way they can tax it and start getting it out of the hands of the criminal gangs, and they can tax it and they can have it regulated. The people in Lakewood are getting safe cannabis, not stuff off the streets. They don't know what's going on with it. There have been stories recently they had cannabis laced with fentanyl coming off the street. So, you know, there's a lot of reasons that communities need to open their doors to this. And so Florida's just the latest state to kind of grapple with this question. And luckily we have a pretty robust judicial system, and all these cases are going through the courts. So the next story comes out of California. It's talking about green energy in cannabis, no pun intended, I don't think. And this has to do with the Monterey Bay Community Power. They have actually reached out to the cannabis community and have held their second sort of symposium or meeting with cannabis companies, reaching out to them saying, hey, you guys should get involved and with green energy, because one of the problems that they're having is getting approval and getting power hooked up to some of these facilities can take quite a long time, especially if you're out of town. And so there, these this local green energy co-op basically is saying, hey, cannabis, maybe look into being more green. Let's get into the, you know, we can work together and do this. This is something that we really need to look at more in the cannabis community. In general, cannabis consumers are environmentally friendly. However, the cannabis community and the cannabis businesses, not the cannabis community, but cannabis businesses and the industry is not always the cleanest or most environmentally friendly. Just look at the packaging issue we have right now in Washington. We have so many packages made out of petroleum products, plastic, and that's all coming out of the state and Olympia saying this is what you have to do. So the cannabis industry could green it up a little bit, and that would be just better for everybody. So good job down in California, the Monterey Bay Community Power Group working with cannabis businesses. So our next story is we're going to be talking about Washington for a second, but we really get started in Ohio, and we're talking about, and this is something I mentioned earlier, in some states, you still can get arrested for cannabis. And in some states like Ohio, it doesn't, in this case, it didn't matter if a couple that was growing medical cannabis at their home, it didn't matter that they had a green card when the 11 officers showed up. They still were taken to jail. All their cannabis still was confiscated. And so in some places, they're not really recognizing these medical cannabis cards. And in Ohio in particular, this has been a state that is just having a heck of a time implementing their medical cannabis system. If you might have read, and I think we covered it on the show at one point, in Ohio they were going something sort of totally different than everybody, and they were going to be dispensing THC by weight, not the flower by weight, but actually THC by weight. So I think they're just having a hard time over there in Ohio implementing it, and as a result people are still getting arrested. Now here in Washington, I'm just going to quickly go over the rules one more time for cannabis. If you are an adult over 21, you can possess up to 1 ounce of flower and 7 grams of concentrate. I believe it's 10 grams of edibles. That's quite a lot. And if you're a medical cannabis patient, you can basically possess 3 times that amount. So you can possess 3 ounces, 21 grams of concentrate, and a lot more edibles. So getting the medical card, you can possess more, because people who are using medical cannabis typically have to use more than people who are using recreational cannabis. So that is the end of our topics for today. Thanks for tuning in to the Cannabis Corner right here on 101.9 KTAH. And our topic today we're going to be talking about today on the Cannabis Corner is a topic that we've talked about before, and it's something that an article that we discussed last show, and that was on clean cannabis. And what sort of got me thinking about this issue, and I've sort of riffed on this on the show before, is the pesticide issue that we had here in Washington. And in particular, recently, Uncle Ike's, a shop up in Seattle, they decided to self-monitor and do some testing on some of their cannabis products. And I don't really want to get into all of the who's and who they were and all this stuff, but they did find some products at their store that were contaminated by pesticides. And there have been some other reports that upwards of 70% of some of the products in the stores are contaminated with pesticides. And I wanted to get somebody on the show today to talk about this topic and talk about the topic of clean cannabis. And today we are joined by Casey Connell of Contender Gardens, has called in today. And how you doing today, Casey?
I'm doing well, Lucas. Yourself?
Yeah, we're doing pretty good today.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. So tell me a little bit about, just so we know what you have going on with clean cannabis, and tell me a little bit how you, your sort of qualifications to talk on this issue. How did you get into clean cannabis and using some of these techniques to grow cannabis at Contender Gardens?
Yeah. During the medical days, you know, prior to the rec, I was growing cannabis and came across a broad mite problem, a broad mite infestation. They're, you know, a pretty terrible little critter. They're really, really small. Some say microscopic, and you can't really get rid of the problem because they're so small. So they'll, with pesticides, for basically they're so small they hide in the crevice, you know, in the node of the plant between these areas where you're not actually getting contact on the plants. And so you can knock back the problem, but they'll just keep coming back. So then I tried everything, you know, heat and aspirin and different pesticides, and I just couldn't get it behind me. And I did some consulting with some farmers in Big Ag, lettuce and strawberry, tomato, and I met this gentleman and spoke with him at length, and he was telling me what some of these people were doing and what he was doing. I'm using this predator mite called an Andersoni or Andersoni, and their favorite prey, which was the broad mite. And sure enough, I bought these beneficial insects. They came in a sachet. It's like a little pouch with a hook on it. You can hook on your plant. They're a time release. There's a little hole in the pouch. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a little bit of food in there, and they'll breed and lay eggs and eat their food and come out of the pouch, you know, right around 4 to 5 weeks of time. And when I applied this, it worked. And, you know, I saw my plants really thrive and come back. And so, you know, right then and there, I felt it was new to me, I saw success right off the bat. And at that time, I had to now cover all my other bases. You know, I had this one beneficial insect that was taking care of one of my issues, or a issue. And so, you know, what would happen suddenly if I were to have now thrips or aphids or, you know, some other pest? I couldn't spray the plants, right? Because I would then, depending on what you're using, you know, you're going to kill your beneficial insects that you're needing to keep your other problem in check. So yeah. I just kind of dove right in and did a lot of reading and kind of got geeked out on it. I'm pretty fascinated by it. And there's a lot of information on these beneficial insects and how to apply them. There's also a lot of misinformation. And a lot of what I've done has just been the application of them and trying different things, different insects for different problems, and controlling your environment differently with humidity and temperature, because that's very important. There was a length there of about 18 months that I went without having to spray a thing. You know, didn't have a problem, kept, you know, implementing and learning about different beneficials and using them as preventatives. And also if I did have a small pest breakout, it's more complicated than it seems, but easier than you think. A lot of attention to detail, and they're not, you know, necessarily cheap like the Andersoni, for example. It is a more expensive insect. These guys come from Europe, some come from Canada, but you know, it is, you are at the end of the day, growing a clean crop. And not all these beneficials are expensive. Some of them are really inexpensive and they're a no-brainer. But
Okay.
knowing like how to use them, how to apply them, release rates, understanding their life cycle and how they do in different environments is all pretty important.
So yeah, you kind of hinted at it. Some of the things that we were talking about with clean cannabis. So you are a licensed I-502 Tier 1 producer over in Spokane. If I were to go to your operation and ask one of your employees, like, what is clean cannabis? What is somebody at Contender Gardens going to tell me exactly the definition that we want to think about when we talk about clean cannabis? Because it's not just about pesticides and bugs.
What probably one of my employees would tell you is that it's harder than it sounds. It's more expensive than other practices. A lot more attention to detail is needed, and I would say a lot more work too. Just being clean and sterile and those preventatives. It's labor intensive, but I think for the most part, they have a grasp of, we try to stick to a regimen and not waver from it. And there's so many factors always, including those that you can't control, right? That are
Yeah.
out of your control, like, where and what your employees do after work, do they have their own garden? Are they a patient or a windstorm blowing your roof off, there's going to be things that you can't control, and even if you did have a state-of-the-art facility, there's always those factors. But I think they understand that it's costly, it's labor-intensive, it's not easy, it doesn't always work, it doesn't always happen. It's not every plant, every harvest, all the time. I think they got a good understanding, though, of the reality of the situation. I think we see a lot of people out there claiming to be pesticide free, and they know firsthand, how they can judge that or what they think about that, because that's not an easy thing to do.
So you were just kind of saying that there's a lot of people saying they're pesticide free. I mean, what are some things that consumers can look for to help so that they might know that their product that they're getting is pesticide free?
I would always say that the retailer or the purchaser or whoever's involved at that level should be asking for the quality analysis for the crop, or let's just say the lot or order that they ordered. The truth is, we only have to provide the laboratory with right around 4 to 6 grams for a quality analysis test, QA test or potency. And the pesticide test is expensive, so it's not realistic for you to pay for a pesticide test every crop, on every plant, particularly, every time. Washington's one of the few states that doesn't have a mandated pesticide QA, and they don't come to your facility to pick out a random sample from anywhere, right? And this goes for potency too. One piece of cannabis isn't going to be an accurate representation of your sale or your order or your crop. Top of the plant's going to test differently than the bottom of the plant. Just because you had a clean or a pesticide-free run crop or structure, greenhouse, room, however you want to call it, doesn't mean that your next one's going to be clean or untouched by pesticides. So even getting the QA, if you were to provide QAs of your pesticide results to your stores, and they were to provide those or have those accessible to the public, to medical patients, it doesn't mean that what you're getting or what you just bought is exactly that, that test result.
Yeah.
The truth is, cannabis has been on Schedule One for so long. There even organic pesticides. We really don't know how harmful that is or not. We're not smoking potatoes and broccoli.
Yeah, that's true.
So there's no research because of it being on Schedule One. So we don't really know the true long-term or short-term effects of some of these pesticides that are even considered organic. And so why go there if you can avoid it, right? If you can grow a clean plant and crop and try to stay clean. At least you know that you're doing your best to put a safe product on the shelf.
Yeah, and it really is all about the safety and having a safe product, and it's also the consumers could they also need to kind of educate themselves. Just as an aside, the DOH also has a list of pesticide-free. Any cannabis product approved by the Department of Health in Washington should be pesticide-free. So that's another thing consumers can kind of look at. So let's talk about the some of the benefits for the plant and then the consumers. And then I know some of these pesticides are pretty environmentally toxic. So maybe if you know mention some of the specific pesticides and kind of the benefits of not using some of these toxic chemicals.
Yeah, well, I mean, like I was saying earlier, that we don't know the true effects of some of these even clean pesticides, so it's hard to say what some of these long-term effects could be on someone. I do feel like, you know, just implementing these standard operating procedures where you really can get ahead of the game early on, excuse me, in the vegetative state of your plants, so, you know, you can go through the flowering state without having to spray or trouble, you know, having issues later down the flowering cycle. But on the list we basically have organic pesticides, and there's quite a bit of them on the PCOL database. They've changed frequently, and some of that has to do with pesticides not being registered or not being renewed. But the truth is, cannabis is new and different, and people are smoking cannabis. You know, it's being concentrated in concentrates, and people are inhaling it. So there is a lot of unknowns. But I think a lot of what people are using or on the PCOL database, horticulture oils is a big one. You know, there's many different kinds of horticulture oil, and they're pretty effective. If it's sesame seed or cottonseed or rosemary oil, neem oil. You know, we all have heard of neem. Fungicides are considered a pesticide, so there's many different. Sulfur, I think, is a big issue that comes up a lot. It is an organic element. It's been used for hundreds of years, but if used on your crop, say in anywhere late into the season, you know, any pesticide is going to transfer over to any kind of extraction if there's residuals, you know, and it's going to be compounded, yeah, Making it extremely unsafe and even deadly, right?
Yeah, if you could take too much. Some of the medical patients, they're a little more compromised systems and stuff. This is something the WSLCB, you know, their medical protocols and everything, it just seems like they just kind of need to step it up a little bit, because there are a lot of people out here that are vulnerable to these pesticides.
Yeah, that, you know, and if it is about safety, right, which it should be, there needs to be some more or different oversight, or maybe different SOPs. And, you know, like I said earlier, Washington, I think, is one of the only states that does not have pesticide testing mandated. And then once again, like I said earlier, it doesn't mean that, hey, this sample I gave the lab, you know, even if it was mandated, right, is an appropriate representation of the crop as a whole.
Yeah, because they can go along and people could use the pesticides on just one plant because it's the only one with a problem, and then two plants over, they're not using it, and then the test only maybe not pick up that one part of the batch that has that specific pesticide in it.
Yeah, or, you know, if someone's grown, you know, has successfully grown a clean round, you know, they might and are struggling on other rounds, they might want to cheat the system and keep some of that product to keep using it for their pesticide test, you know. So there's a lot of issues involved around that. And, you know, I guess you're never going to be perfect. The system's never going to work completely, you know, accurate.
Yeah,
there's educating people, I think, from start to finish, if it's on the consumer medical side or end user side to the farmers and growers as well. And a lot of farmers are under a lot of pressure. Some of the testing was really strict right off the bat to begin with, although they weren't pesticides. You know, it was bile and negative bacteria or yeast and mold. People have put a lot in, all in to their farm, their projects, and so losing a lot or a harvest or a structure, if it's a room, can be devastating to any business.
Yeah, that's a lot. There's a lot at stake, and that's what I was going to ask you next. Why would somebody turn to pesticides? I mean, if there's so many opportunities out there to use implement clean cannabis solutions, and there's a lot of things to educate yourself out there if you're a grower. I mean, why would you use pesticides? Why isn't more people doing the clean cannabis protocols?
I think it comes down to a know-how. I think when 502 first launched, and I got up and running a few years into it, there was very few people using the beneficial insects and biological controls. Now you see more and more of it. So I think there is this learning curve and people getting onto it and learning how to use them. I mean, during the medical days, I didn't know of anybody doing it. And we didn't have potency testing then, or let alone pesticide testing.
No, no.
Nobody cared. Nobody tested. People were using some pretty horrible stuff because they don't want to lose the crop, or they're more thinking about their pocketbooks, and the money they were going to make. So I think pesticides might just be, for the most part, an easier way to deal with something, a cheaper way to deal with the problem. There's other things that matter as well. And I'll go back to like the know-how. I think what I see a lot of is, and I hear a lot of people, I use the beneficials, or I use these predator mites. They didn't work for me. And at the end of the day, what I see a lot of is, people misinterpreting their severity of their infestation and their release rates.
Yeah, okay.
And so, when you look at a plant or a leaf or the underside of a leaf, and you have a certain amount of, eggs, larvae, bugs that you see, and you're supposed to grade that, into what do you consider that? A mild, moderate, is that a heavy infestation, a crucial? And then there's release rates for these different insects, beneficial insects, to be applied to your infestation, depending on the severity. And what I've mostly seen on why it didn't work for people, or they gave up, or they don't believe in them, or is because they didn't assess that properly, and so they didn't know how to apply the proper release rates onto their problem. So, for example, if you find five spider mites on the bottom of a or underside of a leaf, that's considered a heavy infestation. And I think most
Oh, wow.
people wouldn't look at it like that. They would, think, oh, okay, there's five mites here. Oh, it's moderate, or not a big deal, not a problem. And so, and there's a lot to it involved. Temperature and humidity are huge on some of these insects, and a photo period too. And what I mean by that is, your light cycle when you go into flower, and you lose light from your vegetative state to your flowering state. A lot of insects go into what's called diapause, which is like hibernation, and they're not effective anymore. In some instances, with some beneficial insects, you could manipulate the temperature and get the temperature at a warmer state to keep those insects from going into diapause. And some, the temperature wouldn't matter at all. They're going to hibernate regardless, because they think, fall is upon them because of that light cycle change.
Yeah.
And some of these insects, they just won't thrive, or they won't breed. Their eggs won't hatch if your humidity isn't high enough. They're just, it's not effective, and so if you can't dial in your environment to where you need it to get these pests, excuse me, these beneficials to really take off and assist them, to take over the problem or to protect your crop, you're kind of out of luck, right? So there's a lot of information that you need to understand before applying them and being successful at it.
Yeah, and you're right. You have to get it just right. We had a medical grow, and my caretaker, he's somebody been growing cannabis for a long time. And so somehow we got some contaminations from some spider mites, And we were like, oh, yeah, we'll get these beneficial insects. And apparently we just didn't do it quite right because it, you know, it did something, but didn't really quite have the effect. So it's really up to the grower to kind of take that extra step and educate themselves. And that costs money and time and labor. And a lot of times some of these operations, they just don't have that put in there. And what we end up with is a system where people are, you know, one of the big things they sold on the medical back in the medical days on the new system was that it was all going to be clean, and that we had to get rid of the medical because it was so untested and so terrible. And then now we sort of had the same thing back on us in I-502. So just kind of wrap us up, Casey. Where do you see this going as far as the clean cannabis movement? Do you see it increasing? And if somebody wants to know more about Contender Gardens and maybe about clean cannabis, what are some books or some anything, any information you can kind of pass on to our listeners if they want to learn more about this?
Yeah. So, you know, I think when I first started, I thought that this would matter right off the bat, and I was wrong. You know, I thought people would care that the product was clean, and I had zero parts per billion residuals on my plants, and I'd get paid more for it. But the truth is, it's not like that. And I think we can compare that to the organic food industry. I mean, it took over 10 years, probably a good 10 years, for that to make an impact. You know, for that to now be a trend, and people pay more for a clean product. Mm-hmm. Want the organic, right? And it's gonna be this. I see it being the same for cannabis. So we're still very, very many years away from that, I feel. My target market maybe is, you know, a lot of folks from, say, Seattle, mom and pop, parents, or somebody who is very health conscious, highly educated, you know, buys that organic food, cares about what they put in their body, is looking at what they want to consume. But it's still very few and far in between. You know, we're not there yet as a whole, where it's a trend and everybody is. And also we haven't had this research, right? Because of where it sat on Schedule One. So the information isn't there, right? How harmful is some of this stuff, and when it's concentrated after extraction, and, you know, what are some of these long-term side effects? What can it cause? And I think if we had this information, which we should, right, people would be way more aware of what they're what they're inhaling. So, but I would say we're, you know, 7 more years out, give or take. And the longer it stays, you know, the longer it's federally illegal, or the longer it sits on Schedule One, the longer it's going to take to have the information that we need. But I think it's going to be a bit.
Okay.
There is a lot of misinformation online, from what I've noticed, from things I've read online and books I've read as well, and then actually applying some of this stuff in the garden. And so I would just say for the readers to beware. There's a lot of myths as well. One of the books that I really like that I still look back at for information is The Hemp Disease and Pests Management and Biological Control.
Okay.
It's by J.M. McPartland, R.C. Clark, and D.P. Watson. It's not the cheapest book, but it's a really, really good book, pretty scientific and goes in depth. It is a little outdated, although they have updated it. And since this time, too, we have some other beneficial insects that you can get commercially that maybe weren't available during the time the book was written. So it does change some things. But yeah, that's my favorite books.
Okay. Well, hey.
So I would recommend folks to give it a read or have it on their bookshelf.
Yeah, especially maybe buy it for Christmas for some of these producers out there and send it to them, huh?
There you go. There you go. I actually got this book for Christmas. But,
oh, wow.
Yeah. But yeah, I think what I've discovered is, you know, people, I'm not getting paid more for my product. Even on the harvest and the days that we do have a pesticide free and a clean product with no residuals, nobody really cares. People are, you know, looking at the highest THC for the lowest dollar, you know, and so there is still a lot of education to go, right? We have a long way to go with talking about terpenes and educating the public and the end user and the consumer on, those numbers really don't mean anything,
No, it's
and
not. It's definitely not always about the highest THC, and they have some really low cost cannabis out there with the higher THC numbers that is just really not that great. So,
You're right. Yeah, it's an inaccurate representation of if you're allowed to take the sample you want to the lab, well, you're gonna pick maybe the ripest, biggest, prettiest portion of the plant or a plant of that harvest, and it doesn't represent the same numbers as the rest of the crop or the plant or the bottom side of the plant. It's not realistic.
yeah, that's a good point.
And but I think we'll get there in time.
Yeah, as some more of these states legalize it and it becomes more normalized, I think we'll some of the, I think a lot of the universities getting involved and kind of start taking this up to the next level, because it's been underground for so long that it just hasn't been a lot of, a lot of research into it. But Washington State, we were one of the first, and it's great that we are sort of leading the way in this field. So, yeah, thanks for joining us today, Casey, and we hope to have you on the show again, and see you next time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'd really like to thank Casey for coming in there. A lot of good information there. So just remember, when you go into the stores, ask about clean cannabis. You can actually ask for the accompanying materials at the counter there and see what pesticides are being used. Some packaging may still have the pesticide list on it, but they're not required to put that on the packaging anymore. You have to ask and get the accompanying materials. So be sure to look at that if you have any kind of questions. It is something that you really want to pay attention to. And I'd like to thank Casey again for coming in and talking to us about that. So next up, we're going to get into our It's a Bust segment. And this comes out of Florida. Unfortunately, a man tried to fly in from California, from San Francisco, I believe, to Tallahassee. When he was leaving, they found the cannabis in his luggage, but they didn't do anything to him in California. I now that I think about it, I think this is kind of odd. They didn't do anything to him in California, like, "Hey, sir, get off the plane. You can't take that." They just called ahead over to because he had, according to the article, he hadn't left when he was just on the plane when they found it. So he had not left when they found it. They just called ahead to Florida and alerted the Florida authorities there that he was coming with the cannabis. And then when he got there, they were waiting for him and arrested him. And that just doesn't seem right to me. And on top of that, it's a flower, folks. The police in the article seem really proud of themselves over there in Florida for catching this guy. And yeah, we want to respect our police, and we do need them in our community, and we do want to tip our hats to what they're doing out there a lot of the times. But 50 pounds, it's just flower. And believe me, where he got off there in Tallahassee, within 2 or 3 miles of there's way more than 50 miles of cannabis there in Tallahassee. So we really need to stop arresting people for a plant. And I'm actually going to look into this a bit more, because I want to know why the police in California didn't take him off the plane there in California and stop him to go from going to Florida, instead of just letting him go and get arrested. So that does not seem right. So that is our It's a Bust segment for this week, and thanks so much for tuning in. If you'd like to follow more of what I'm doing with cannabis, you can follow me on all the social media platforms out there at MJ Is Medicine. So thanks so much for tuning in today. Bye bye.
This is Cannabis Corner, hosted by Lucas Barfield. If you would like to get in contact with your host, he is on Twitter at MJIsMedicine. Your musical selection is The Happy Monster by Chubby Jackson and his orchestra, recorded on 78 in 1947. You can find this music and much more at The Great 78 Project, an archive of historical music recordings at great78.archive.org. You are listening to 101.9 KTAH, Radio Tacoma.